It's the 19th of July 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Will we ever get rid of our nuclear weapons, or would that be mad? How do you turn a block of flats into a block of twats? Are Chinese lanterns really a huge fire risk, or has that theory gone up in smoke? And has a golf club banned women, or are all the women just sensible and they've realised that if they go there, they'll have to watch golf? Before we begin the traditional begging slot, if you enjoy the show, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us pay all the server bills and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now we start this week with nuclear weapons and the debate over replacing Trident. It turns out that the options are not nuclear, but unclear. So this week the government's Trident Alternatives report was published. It's a heated debate, not least amongst the coalition who look set to fission over it, with the Tories wanting a full replacement and the Lib Dems wanting to pour some heavy water all over it. But will we ever be able to get rid of our nukes? To analyse the situation, I had a chat with Paul Ingram from the British American Security Information Council, or BASIC. They're a think tank who have been thinking about the issue. I started by asking him what was the politics behind the review, and did the government just not know what to do?
Well, of course, nuclear disarmament has played a key role in the past in British politics, and that is a sort of shadow that overcasts on all of the debate around nuclear weapons. But the Conservative government's very keen on replacing the current Trident submarines with a new fleet of four ballistic missile submarines, so that's like for like. The Liberal Democrats went into the last election opposed to that policy, and the coalition government, when it was formed, agreed to disagree on this. The Trident Alternatives review that was published this week was the expression of that disagreement and the demand from the Liberal Democrats that alternatives be considered seriously with a proper researched study. But the problem with this study, of course, is that it has had no external expert review prior to publication, and a number of the assumptions that it's operating under are very much government assumptions. The Liberal Democrats are basically forced by this report into quite a tight corner, because the report makes some quite serious assumptions around the length of time it would take to produce a new nuclear warhead. So the politics of this are that the Liberal Democrats are probably now on the defensive. They certainly seem to be this week, even though nuclear weapons are seen by the general public out there as less relevant than they were. We're all fully aware that it's been a quarter of a century since the end of the Cold War, and yet we seem to be investing in a like-for-like replacement of a system that was dreamed up when we faced a Soviet threat and the possibility of facing that threat alone.
As you say, this report seems to be the result of, I think at the time it was phrased, kicking it into the long grass, and I guess now we're there picking it up again. And is that why things went so quiet? Have the options changed now? Because we've heard about, the report talks about a very number of other options, sort of like, you know, less submarines and that sort of thing.
Yes. So the Liberal Democrats will definitely be pushing for a smaller fleet, either two or three submarines. Now, two submarines would be quite radical from the perspective of the government, because what it will entail is at times when the nuclear deterrent would not be available. Now, of course, some of us might think that that's appropriate given the current or likely security situation that Britain will face, but others feel that that's not the case.
What do you make of the current quality of the debate that's going on? I mean, the one thing I get on my high horse about is, I think this, you know, when people say, well, we need to worry about the threat from North Korea and Iran, I think that's a bit of a red herring, isn't it? Because it's all about existential threats.
Yes, so it's very difficult to imagine a credible scenario where Britain faces a nuclear-armed Iran or North Korea alone. And this is one of the core assumptions behind all of this debate that seems to be accepted by all three main political parties, which is that Britain needs to retain the capability of facing any threat globally in a situation where the Americans are not themselves involved, which seriously isn't realistic, displays no trust of the alliances we have and no sort of feet on the ground in terms of the reality of what we may face over the next few decades. So I think it gives away a sense that the political elites in this country are still wedded to this concept of Britain being an imperial power with responsibilities to project force around the world and to then defend itself against all comers, and this clearly isn't realistic.
Do you think that's because British politicians are just sort of beset by these delusions of grandeur, or are they thinking in terms of realistic security needs today?
Well, British politicians are no different from any other human beings. We're all captured by our history and our legacy and by our childhood fantasies. And I think that they are certainly captured by that. A realistic assessment of the threat over the next few decades would certainly throw up a whole bunch of potential threats, including climate change and the like, that require states to pull together and cooperate rather than operate independently in a sort of anarchical way, each one defending their own interests. If we go down that second route, then it's quite likely that we will face huge challenges around climate change and potentially nuclear proliferation and a likely consequential nuclear war.
Do you have any insight into how sort of defence thinking goes? Because from my perspective, I've from an international relations background. You look at the world and it does get more interconnected. We see, you know, globalisation, more cooperation, and really, it's like, you know, war just doesn't seem like something that can happen these days.
Yes, but the problem is that the defence establishment, and by that I mean most of the politicians and the officials responsible for defence policy, still are attached to the concept that the government ultimately is responsible for the security of the nation against all potential threats. And so they take a worst-case scenario of a threat to Britain, and that trumps all the other potential requirements for Britain to cooperate with other states to try to get rid of nuclear threats or to address climate change or the like. In the end, nuclear weapons still, in the eyes of the defence establishment, present the ultimate threat to Britain, and therefore the government has the ultimate responsibility to meet that threat head on. And they conclude that the only way to do that is by responding with a nuclear deterrent. So they are willing to contemplate Britain engaging in mass annihilation in order to protect Britain, and they ignore the consequences, both the global cooperation, but also for the moral standing of this state. It's very difficult to engage in global cooperation with states that we are actually threatening global annihilation with.
Conversely, do you think if we got rid of the nukes, that if it'd be a much easier sell for us to say to other countries, you probably shouldn't have them?
Well, it would indeed be an easier sell, and it wouldn't actually open us up to any significant threat in any conceivable time frame, because there are other states who are closely allied to who have nuclear weapons. So even if one does fully sign up to the concept of nuclear deterrence, we have to look at the big picture, not just a little Englander picture. And the big picture suggests that we need to be cooperating much more closely with states across the world. Now, it must be stated quite clearly that Iran is not going to give up its nuclear program on the basis that Britain might give up its nuclear weapons. But that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the international regimes and institutions that back them up need to be seen as legitimate by all states, or certainly by the vast majority. And the challenge is not only coming from states like Iran and North Korea, but also from states such as Brazil, South Africa, and a number of other states who perceive the current status quo as unjust, and therefore resist the very necessary requirements to tighten up non-proliferation measures. Now, if Britain were to get rid of its nuclear weapons, then there would be a much greater chance of bringing together the vast bulk of the international community to strengthen non-proliferation and to move towards a nuclear weapon-free world.
Do you think part of the problem debating it, and the reason it's taking so long to debate, is that there is a sort of a weird disconnect? Because on the one hand, we've got to have this sort of internal political argument about whether to spend the money on all these sorts of things. But on the other hand, the politicians on a diplomatic international level want to look tough. You don't want to say to Russia and China, we might be disarming ourselves. We need to sort of present almost two different fronts.
Well, the thing is that... If you are serious about moving down the ladder multilaterally, then you have to go to the disarmament table with something clear to offer. Now, we're not doing that today, because what we're saying in our domestic debate is we're saying we have a minimum deterrent. We cannot go any lower. We have to have a submarine out at sea at all times. And so it begs the question, if Britain were indeed to sit down with the Russians and the Chinese, which incidentally we're not, but if we were to sit down with them and enter into serious negotiations, what do we have to offer other than giving up the whole thing? And that's not credible at the moment, because it's clear from the debate this week that no main politician leader is in favour of nuclear disarmament. So we have to bear in mind that requirement. And what that requirement means is that we as a country have to outline what our disarmament ladder is, outline the conditions that will enable us to step down that ladder, and invite the other nuclear weapon states to join us in that project of global nuclear disarmament.
That sounds all rather interesting. So, final question, picture the scene, you're the Prime Minister, you're in number 10, what exactly would you do right now?
I would explain my intention to move Britain further down this disarmament ladder. I would immediately take the submarines off patrol, which is completely unnecessary in this current environment. I would mothball the two newer submarines and keep the other two submarines available. This would immediately extend the life of the current system by another 10 years. And I would then invite the other nuclear weapon states to the disarmament table and negotiate seriously with them on a timetable for disarmament. That's a realistic program that doesn't involve us abandoning our nuclear deterrent immediately, and therefore should be assuring those in this country that are not yet ready for that. It would be politically realistic, and it would give us the chance of actually playing the leadership role that many in this country seem to think we're playing, but we haven't really played it up until now.
Paul Ingram, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now, it turns out that dickheads are being encouraged to live together. And surprisingly, this story isn't about a Tory frontbench away day. This week, Dawn Firth Godby here has been getting angry at some bewildering property development plans and the media's complacent reaction to it. Here she is to explain more.
A story in London's Evening Standard last week reported the news that club owner Nick House is developing a block of apartments for cool under 40-year-olds. The Mahiki and Whiskey Mist co-owner wants to create a micro-society that is dynamic, social and fun, according to the Standard. But why is this kind of story seemingly lapped up by its readers rather than filling them with outrage? It might seem insignificant to some, but the concept of this idea is wrong on so many levels. It's at least elitist, ageist and snobbish. The article explains how the flats will be exclusively available to those who are successful and in their 20s and 30s, and that the residents will be hand-picked. The term exclusive should be the first alarm bell that rings, warning us of the elitist arrogance of Mr. House. Secondly, the word successful, which of course means rich. This suggests a touch of prejudice of the poor and of the less well off. But it also reveals the tendency that presides in 21st century Britain to measure success in terms of how much money we have, not in happiness or pleasure of your work as someone might be if they're a physicist or a doctor or a zookeeper, as they do in some countries such as Denmark. House, no doubt would not consider these to be the right kind of success. The price will put pay to that. But he openly admits his opinion of an ideal owner would be an advertising executive or, quote, 30-year-old tech startups. The next bone to pick is the clearly ageist comment that they will only be available to those in their 20s and 30s. Am I right in thinking that there are laws against this kind of thing? Perhaps House and his clients are so cool that they're immune to the law. But can we assume that he does not plan to live there himself since his 40th birthday will be in a couple of years' time? Finally, House explains reassuringly that residents will be handpicked at first, quote, to set the right cool tone, end quote. Apparently, a patron figure will receive deliveries and will help organise the residents' daily lives. That's a concierge then, or a cleaner, or a PA maybe. So basically, what we have here is an 80s-style yuppie pad dressed as something new, since another of his selling points is his no-suits policy. Where he's managed to get his money from to fund the project is a mystery, as a little investigation reveals his companies are not exactly flush, suggesting he isn't worth as much as he lets on, which makes the story even more interesting. How can someone of almost 40 with no real fortune actually fit into this compartment that he's created? He even admits that the gentrified Williamsburg neighbourhood in Brooklyn was what influenced his idea, and he doesn't see a problem with this. This is an area of London where flats in poor condition still go for in the region of £1 million, and doesn't he think that area is gentrified enough? For those who might not know, gentrification is a renovation of the middle or upper classes of areas that were previously run down. On the upside, a dilapidated neighbourhood is transformed and improved. On the downside, however, the area becomes too expensive for those who are living in the area, and they are forced out and finish up either in a worse neighbourhood or are made to move further away, in some cases end up moving out of their city. Londoners already know what gentrification did for Notting Hill and Shoreditch, which were affordable areas of London that became impossible for those on lower incomes to live in, forcing people with less to move on into poorer areas. The main issue I'm trying to bring up here is that the journalist who originally covered this doesn't appear to have picked up on the absurdity of this story. Though I hoped for at least a hint of sarcasm when it was reported that, for example, the properties will have galley kitchens since it's expected that residents will be eating out regularly, I fear this is not the case. This is a failure on the journalist's part to criticise Mr. House's attitude. They could argue, however, that they are being impartial, but impartiality rarely seems to trouble that kind of journalist. To my knowledge, there was little, if any, backlash on this story, yet it's loaded with what could only be called prejudice of one kind or another. It makes me wonder, how are the public convinced that it is acceptable for people like this to exclude people in this way, and why do a large majority of consumers lap it up? This report is a tiny drop in the ocean of this type of media. OK Magazine, for example, is bursting with rich, successful people, most of whom many of us haven't heard of until they show up in a photograph of some Chelsea party. They're just rich, and rich equals successful, and what we're all supposed to be. And with this comes the fame and admiration that many aspire to. Made in Chelsea is another example of this. Who are these people, and why do people care? And on an aside, how did they manage to bag an award at the BAFTAs? There's a lot of work being done in the media studies on the subject of media audiences that tries to understand why it is that consumers will buy into these ideals, and whether the press influence audiences or the audience influence the press. Some of the research suggests it might be a little bit of both, and of course the press would argue that they cater for the demands of the audience. And there is evidence to support this, which is a little disconcerting considering some of the material that is out there. Am I the only one who thinks this fascination of the rich is frankly disturbing? What is particularly irritating though is that we're all supposed to be in awe of these people and of this pompous attitude. Audiences clearly are tantalised with the idea that we can aspire to be like them. Of course, most of us might be lying if we said that we didn't want to be rich and successful. But do we really want to be people like Nick House and the cast of Made in Chelsea? This is Dawn Firth, Godby here, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now, what happens when something good, like recycling, has bad outcomes? This week, our resident fire scientist, Claire Benson, has been despairing at the inability of the media to report on the nuances of a complex issue by blaming poor, defenceless Chinese lanterns instead. Here's Claire to explain more.
Just a couple of weeks ago, on the 31st of June, a fire broke out in the town of Smethwick, just outside of Birmingham. It was so serious that the West Midlands Fire Brigade and other neighbouring brigades were forced to dedicate over 200 firefighters at once and more than 35 fire appliances across 3 days. A large recycling plant full of refuse, including 100,000 metric tons of plastics, set for recycling, had been ignited, and soon the huge fire load was burning out of control. The inferno the brigades faced was captured brilliantly in John McNaughton's astonishing photograph of firefighters tackling the flames in a field of plastic. Such a serious and high-profile event has, of course, led to a large number of media reports. Aside from informing the public about the simple facts surrounding the events, a torrent of supplementary reports have highlighted various issues attached to the incident. While some reports have focused on the fact that many of the fire engines used to fight the fire may not exist if proposed government and service cuts go ahead, the main focus of the collective media ire has been so-called Chinese or floating lanterns. While still in the early stages of fighting the fire, investigators started to look for the cause and were confident they had found it in a flame identified as a Chinese lantern spotted on security footage falling from the sky onto the stacks of rubbish. Following this finding, and while the fire still raged, the mainstream media was absolutely saturated with stories proclaiming the evils of this flamey menace. Headlines like, "Ban Chinese lanterns before they cause a fatal fire," "Chinese lanterns cause animals slow and painful death," and "Anger as Kate Middleton's parents sell deadly Chinese lanterns," appeared across news outlets. Now, I'm not denying that there's a problem with these objects. There really is. Nor am I criticising West Midlands Fire for using this event to publicise the risks of sending unattended fires into the sky. That's their job, and it's a good and worthwhile one. The various dangers of these objects have been known for some time. Some extremely serious fires have been identified as having been started by Chinese lanterns, and call me killjoy, but personally, I really can't understand the logic of a society that regards someone lighting a stationary bin on fire as, at best, a public nuisance, and at worst, a reckless act of endangerment, but also releases scores of unattended small fires into the air with no thought to where they'll land. It's difficult to know just how many fires have been started by this, because it hasn't been specifically recorded, but in 2011, The Telegraph reported that brigades around the country had been called out 100 times in the previous 2 years. This won't sound like much or particularly serious to some people, but of course, it doesn't include the smaller fires or near misses, and does rather depend what they land on, doesn't it? Which brings me to my main point. Reading all the stories online and seeing reports on the telly, I have to say I've been getting annoyed, because while I agree Chinese lanterns are a bit of a menace, I can't help but feel that they are the easy scapegoat hiding a far bigger issue, and that's the recycling centres themselves. It's hardly a scientific measure, but since April of this year, the BBC News website has produced stories on 12 serious fires around the country, as well as Smethwick. One fire in a compost plant in Berkshire, which started last November, wasn't put out fully until the following June. And 2 days after I started writing this piece, I spotted a huge plume of smoke in the sky. I was in Doncaster. The fire on another recycling plant was all the way in Sheffield. Now, I've spoken to a number of fire professionals about these plants, and they believe that this is probably covered by existing building and workplace fire and other health and safety regulations. And there hasn't been any suggestion, or even the hint of an implication from them, that any of the officials charged with inspecting these facilities have failed in their roles or in any way cut corners. And yet it does appear that there is some sort of problem with these facilities, if not because of the number of incidents, then because of the amount of public resources they consume. I can't help but wonder if the regulations or even legislation need to be re-examined. There have been suggestions that there's too much material being stored, and that the height and separation of bales or piles needs to be looked at again. Some people even think that it's time to have foam monitors on site, robots that can apply foam as soon as a fire is located. A new technology has been developed that can triangulate a fire's location for remote firefighting. Of course, all that very expensive is likely to be unpopular with the industry and could easily increase the cost of recycling. This sort of event is rarely simple, and the solutions can have complicated repercussions. But whether it's because members of the press don't understand all of the issues, aren't given time to understand, or just don't credit the public with the intelligence to get something so complex, it seems to me to be a real shame that in spite of a number of people, including MP Tom Watson on Twitter, mentioning the seemingly continuous reports of recycling fires, articles just seem to refer to this issue in passing. That was in spite of West Midlands Fire Brigade stating that it visited 15 serious fires in the waste and recycling industry just this year. In this situation, I really don't know what the solution is, but finding the answer is entirely dependent on asking the right questions in the first place. July the 6th marked 25 years since the Piper Alpha disaster, a catastrophic event caused in many ways by an industry deluding itself on the level of safety precautions they had in place. I really hope the media and our wider society doesn't wait for the next big disaster to start asking the big questions on safety in these new and emerging industries. This is Claire Benson for the Pod Delusion.
Now, over in Northern Ireland, violence and conflict has flared up again following the Orange Order parades and the flag protests. So in this next report, we're going to hear from a Northern Irish politician on what this all means.
Mr. Mulfag MLA, you've been watching these demonstrations on the streets of Belfast. Now, is this a return to the bad old days?
Well, it is a return to the bad old days, but it isn't really as bad as people are making out. We've been through a difficult time over the last 15 years or so, since the Good Friday Agreement, and the two sides of Northern Ireland have been slowly losing their sense of identity. And this vibrant twin culture that we cherish in the six counties was beginning to merge into a sort of a generic monotony. Hopefully this signals a move away from that.
Do you think we need to be careful about allowing this situation to descend into violence?
Well, we need to be careful specifically of the generation born in the late 90s that grew up not really knowing who it was in their community that they had to hate.
Who to hate?
Well, it's part of us, isn't it? Our identity is defined by our group and therefore those not in our group. And as a result of the Good Friday Agreement, and I might add the sort of liberal middle-class parent that thought our vibrant history was not suitable for their children, there are kids who haven't got that sense of in and out. Here in Northern Ireland, we need our parents and our community leaders to be consistently reiterating to all our young people who it is that they have to hate. These events in Belfast show that we're suddenly starting to get that message through, and that can only be a good thing.
In what way?
Well, look, if you don't tell your children constantly who the other side are, how are they going to know who to hate when they grow up? How are they going to know which side of the road is unfriendly? They run the risk of seeing everyone as equal and normal human beings like them, when in fact, those kids are different. They're from different cultures and they're not the same. And people need to respect that. People need to respect different traditions in Northern Ireland and not try to merge them into some kind of bland mishmash. We are our culture.
Okay, you're arguing to ensure traditions and cultures are respected. But can't education of each other's religion allow that to happen while still maintaining your own heritage?
Well, education of course plays a key role, and of course this is an area where we are much further ahead than the rest of the UK. When parents fail their children, often the state has to step in and make up the shortfall. But by ensuring that we have segregation by religion ingrained in our education system, we can be confident that all of our children will know exactly who to hate, even if their parents have let them down by withholding them that heritage.
So, rather than condemn the violence, you would encourage it?
Well, this is who we are, and these are our six counties, and any moves to change that should be resisted.
Mr. Mulfag, MLA, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, next month, London is going to host its first Skepticamp, a new style of skeptical conference. To find out more about this day-long event, earlier on I spoke to Chris Higgins, who's organising the event, and I started by asking him the most obvious thing to tell us exactly what a Skepticamp is.
So Skip to Camp's what they're calling a new model for conferencing among skeptics. And the idea being that there's loads of big conferences like TAMS and QEDs that have speakers, international speakers that come from all over the world and people that want to shake their hand and get the book signed and all that kind of stuff. Skeptic Camp's more about community building and just working with local people at a sort of grassroots level. So the Skeptic Camp is organized by the people who are attending. So there's a small committee of volunteers, whether it could be 2-3 people, it could be up to sort of, you know, 15-20, whoever wants to get involved and sort of muck in and pull their resources to put on a conference that loads of people can attend and sort of meet like-minded people, share their ideas and make connections.
And the really unique thing is the lineup of speakers isn't decided until the day.
Well, pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's what's called like an open event and kind of an open source event, really, is that you can kind of do whatever you want with it. You can take the rough idea and go wherever you choose to. So with London, we're letting people book in advance. If they've got a talk they want to give, they can pre-book it and select a time and sort of, you know, hopefully that'll be the schedule on the day. But a lot of skeptic camps, I went to the Sydney one a couple of times, and they have a bit of butcher's paper on the wall, and when you turn up at 9:30 in the morning, you write your name up on the wall, and that's it. It goes from there. It really sort of evolves over the day.
Do you know yet what we can expect to see at the forthcoming London Skeptic Camp in terms of what sort of talks?
I think there's about 4 speakers booked so far. 3 of them are organisers. So we're definitely on the lookout for more speakers and more attendees. But I think it's kind of a, you know, people's special interests. If, you know, a lot of people, my special interest is kind of magic and conjuring. That's how I got into skepticism. Other people are really interested in science and other people are interested in psychology. And so I think if you've got that kind of little niche specialism that you're interested in, you're welcome to present a talk on that. So you end up getting some really interesting stuff. We had a guy in Sydney a few years ago that did a talk on skepticism in aviation, sort of regarding things about the people's unnatural fear of flying and the science behind flight and the statistics about how unlikely it is for planes to crash and all that kind of stuff. So it really has a tendency to bring out some interesting and unique talks.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. I'm scared of flying, so I think it's basically an affront to God. But you're going to be talking at the London event, I guess. Doing something? Are you going to be talking at the London event?
I've put my name down. We'll see how many other speakers we get and see whether I bottle out on the day. But no, I should definitely be talking at the London event. Yeah.
What's your thing? Are you going to be talking about magic?
Yeah, I hope so. It's not written, but it's a talk I've sort of been making notes about for a while. Just about the secrets of the magic community that I'm not supposed to share with anyone, but will anyway, because I'm a maverick. Yeah,
you're like that guy from a few years ago, the masked magician.
Yeah, just not as rich.
So okay, it all sounds fascinating. It's going to be a great day of talks. Give us the details. Where, when, how?
Okay, so it's on the 24th of August, which is a Saturday. It's up in London at Conway Hall, which is number 25 Red Lion Square, and the tickets are £5. And that money will go back into sort of next year's event. It's a not-for-profit event. There's no money being made regarding this. If we break even, awesome. If we have more than even, then we'll put more money back into doing it next year. So there's a website, skepticcamp.co.uk, and that has all the information on it and the ability to buy tickets now, and it will kind of grow over the course of the next 6 weeks and have plenty of information on it for people on the day. And once Skeptic Camp's finished, I believe it's off to the pub.
Brilliant. And we'll put links to find out more on the Pod Delusion website. Chris Higgins, thank you very much.
No problems, James. Cheers, mate.
And now, the sport. No, don't go away. There's actually some gender politics in here too, so it's okay to listen. This week, a big golf tournament takes place in Scotland, and bizarrely, women aren't allowed in the club it's taking place at. That's right, it turns out that the first rule of golf club is no women. Astonishingly, it turns out that this isn't an isolated case either, as Sean Slater now explains.
This weekend sees the Golf Open Championship taking place at the course owned by the Honourable Company of Edinburgh Golfers at Muirfield, near the quiet Scottish seaside town of Gullen. the elite of the world's golfers will gather on the East Lothian coast to do battle for the Claret Jug, the honour of winning, and of course the £945,000 in prize money. The Open is the world of golf's oldest and most prestigious tournament, its equivalent of Wimbledon. The tournament has been played continuously, with a couple of breaks for fighting Germans, since 1860, and in that time it has been played at only a handful of selected courses in Scotland and England. The Muirfield course was opened in 1891, when the Honourable Company of Edinburgh Golfers, who had themselves been around since 1744, concluded that the publicly owned course at Musselburgh, a course that had itself been in existence since before the 1670s, had too many common people playing there. Their solution was to build their own exclusive course on links 20 miles east of the city. The following year, the Open Championship moved to Muirfield and would never be played at Musselburgh again. There is no doubt that Muirfield is a beautiful place, blending in perfectly with the dunes and windswept grasslands on the Firth of Forth. Most golfers agree that it is one of the world's best courses to play on, and it offers a perfect challenge to the elite of the sport for first-class competitions. But there is one huge and ugly blot on its pristine landscape greens. The club actively and openly discriminates against 50% of the population. Women are not welcome to join the membership. Women can play the course under certain unique strictures, but they cannot become members entitled to access certain social areas, unless behind the bar, serving food or cleaning the floors, of course, or sit on the committees. Now, you might argue, why would any woman want to join such a club? And as a private members' organisation, surely they have the legal right to discriminate as they wish. And to an extent, I would agree with you. To become a member of this club and others like it is extremely expensive and near impossible for the vast majority of men. They exclude all but the richest and well-connected anyway. There are only 700 members at Muirfield and 80% of them rarely have ever actually played golf. So to 99.9% of the men of Scotland's capital, they would not stand a chance of joining either. But the discriminatory policy based on gender is symptomatic of the wider issue still affecting the sport as a whole. In continuing to select Muirfield and three other clubs that still hold such restrictions, Royal Troon on the West Coast, the Royal Ancient in St Andrews and Royal St George's in Kent, the RNA, the governing body for the sport, are at least accepting the policy and I would argue, that they are actively promoting it. Peter Dawson, the chairman of the RNA and the man who has the authority to actually make some changes, has found the issue of single-sex golf clubs a subject he has constantly had to deal with recently, and this year's Open has highlighted the issue even more. In April, he said that golf today was substantially different from 20 years ago, that no UK course is barred to men or women players, and that the clubs, being private members' organisations, are acting within the law on discrimination. He added that, to think that the RNA might say to a club like Muirfield, you're not going to have the Open anymore unless you make changes to your policy, is frankly a bullying position that we would never take. So it's bullying to say to people not to discriminate or risk losing a ton of money? Dawson also claimed that my personal position is that I totally believe in equality, but I do also believe that there are times when men need to socialise with men and women need to socialise with women. The issue is not particularly that private members' clubs should or should not discriminate. After all, if people want to get together with the same sort of people as themselves, then good luck to them. The issue is that a multi-million pound world sport is failing to drag itself into the 20th century, never mind the 21st, by not taking a clear and unequivocal stance on gender discrimination, especially in its most prestigious tournament. Though few clubs have had such blatant discriminatory policies, the separation of men and women is much more insidious and deep-rooted in the whole sport. The language used in most clubs is patronising towards the ladies. The whole atmosphere reminds me of that advert for Australian beer, where two bottles of sherry were added to a truck-breaking drinks order for the ladies. Not far from where I live is London Ladies Course, the oldest ladies course in the world. A female-only 9-hole membership club attached to the men-only 18-hole club in London Links on the Fife Coast. The ladies club is run by and for ladies, just as the gents is run by and for the gentlemen. For these clubs and others like them, there is a nominal separate but equal policy. But, like racial segregation, we can guess what that means on the ground. Golf is a great sport, and that, in my view, should have much better reputation. It is one of the few games where, thanks to the handicap system, people of all abilities and age ranges and even sexes can play against each other in equal competition. It offers good exercise for almost all levels, and in my opinion offers excellent examples of sporting behaviour and etiquette. In Scotland, it is much more egalitarian than it is elsewhere in the world. Most small towns, even villages, have a golf club nearby which will offer relatively inexpensive membership schemes. In the vast majority of them, anyone is welcome to become a member and encouraged to actively participate. There are over 90 courses within a 20-mile radius of Glasgow, and in Edinburgh there are 6 courses owned and run by the City Council that actively encourage everyone to play regardless of ability or even dress code. On my local authority-owned courses, kids can play in the school holidays for as little as £4 for a round. Unfortunately, though, the sport is still perceived as a male sport, even at this level. Whilst it's great to see kids being actively encouraged to take up the game, in my experience, it is sadly rare to see girls playing it in anything like the numbers of boys. Forcing one already anachronistic and elitist club to open its membership up to women is not going to change this. But taking a stand on this subject would be the beginnings of a clear direction from above that might lead to a change in this damaging, discriminatory atmosphere, and maybe then open up the sport to a far wider audience and allow the sport to thrive. I've been Sean Slater reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now today sees the release of the new film The World's End, in which Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are confronted with body snatcher type aliens. So this week, Chris Chapman has been looking back at this classic cinema trope. Now, whilst there are no World's End spoilers here, there probably are some about some of the older films that Chris mentions. So consider this your spoiler warning. Bruce Willis is a ghost. Here's Chris.
The World's End is now out in cinemas, the final part of the Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright and Nick Frost cornetto trilogy of unconnected movies. This time, it casts the heroes as men returning to their hometown to complete a pub crawl, only to discover the town has been replaced by robot alien imposters. Which got me thinking, if you're an alien seeking to insidiously take over the world, where's the best place to actually start your campaign to replace the human race? Ignore the questions of why would you want to or how is this possible. Basically put science on the shelf for now. What's the best way to take over the world, Hollywood style? First, a caveat. It's not just aliens trying to replace people and taking over the world in Hollywood. The 70s had a slew of movies including robot imposters such as The Stepford Wives and Beyond Westworld. These are beyond the pure purview of this investigation. As a TV show such as The Invaders, or stranger variations such as the body-snatching alien invasion episodes of the Linda Carter version of Wonder Woman. This is just movies. And first up is the most obvious example of the genre, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The defining film of the trope, it's set in a peaceful, idyllic 1950s small town in America. It then sees the alien invaders slowly replace the happy townsfolk with emotionally dead plant replicas. The ending, with the hero rushing to warn the world that the pod people have taken over his town, is a classic. A panicked man, rushing among traffic, screaming like a lunatic to a disbelieving world. The ending had to be changed with a framing device to ensure his warning was at least possibly heeded. The movie's success is as much down to the time and tone as it was the creepy sci-fi element. It was set in America at the height of the Cold War, and body snatchers, devoid of emotion, represented communism. But later body snatcher movies expanded on the theme. In the 1970s, a Donald Sutherland version of the story, this time set in San Francisco, focused on the idea of society becoming disinterested in the lives of others. Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock himself, was part of the cast, bringing a cool analysis when the heroine believes her boyfriend has been changed. This time, the aliens win. And later, in a 90s version set on an army base, it based the idea of regimented lifestyles as a cloak for the invasion. Anyone questioning authority or conformity was immediately singled out. Again, the aliens probably win, with the hero and heroine fleeing to find another army base similarly taken over. But moving away from the body snatchers movies themselves, other movies have taken a similar tone. In 1998, Robert Rodriguez brought The Faculty, about a school being overtaken by aliens. First, the aliens take the teachers, controlling the students, before deliberately targeting the school's hierarchy. The popular kids are converted, meaning that the social outcasts are the only ones left untouched by the invasion. Inevitably, this includes a sci-fi nerd who's rather genre savvy, and he automatically assumes the worst and just manages to defeat the evil alien queen. But the novel that spurned this whole trend off, The Body Snatchers, is not the first to tackle the subject of alien invasion through replicants. In fact, my favourite film looking at these themes was based on a novella, Who Goes There, by John W. Campbell Jr. in 1938. In it, a team of remote Antarctic research base assistants and scientists are replaced one by one by a shape-shifting alien organism. By the end of the story, after science has been used to defeat the alien, the survivors realise that 15 of their 37 crew have been replaced, with the alien even impersonating panicked members and the devoutly religious. This, of course, spawned the 1982 classic The Thing, the second movie based on the tale, but by far the best. One by one, the station staff are replaced by the horrors of The Thing, until only two survivors are left. Neither man trusts the other, neither knows if the other has been replaced. It's all about paranoia. So, what's this taught us about alien invasion? First, you can take over small towns, but someone's probably going to get out. It's better to target bigger cities, as you're more likely to go undetected. Schools are relatively easy to take over, but target the geeks first, as they're likely to be the ones to suspect anything. Army bases are fair game, and you can use conformity to your advantage. Antarctic research bases may seem a good idea, but the isolation means you're going to be trapped along with your potential victims, and they should probably be avoided. But what do you do if you're rumbled? Well, I'd cite the tactic used in Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters, again published in 1951, before The Body Snatchers. A movie of it came out in the 1990s, meaning that it's eligible for this criteria, and the plot involves the invasion of parasitic alien slugs that sit on the back of humans controlling their every actions. The slugs quickly take over the entire middle of America, from Minnesota to Louisiana, and prevent the military action against them by using host children as human shields. As soon as they're discovered, the aliens launch a full active invasion of the east and western US. Now, this doesn't happen in the movie, but it does happen in the novel. The human hosts don't work always, so the slugs use cats, dogs, horses, and even elephants in their assault. Ultimately, their attack only fails because of infection. The classic Deus Ex Machina of aliens being more susceptible to human disease than humans, first employed, of course, by H.G. Wells in War of the Worlds. So, out of these options, I'd give the aliens in the second Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie, the Donald Sutherland version in the 1970s, the best chance of global success. They'd successfully taken over San Francisco, giving them access to the rest of the world, and had captured all major lines of communication. In the end, when the lone, non-converted straggler tries to make contact, the single show of emotion brings an entire city of pod people down upon her. But who knows? Maybe the world's end has an even better ending. Perhaps the path to global domination starts in Letchworth Garden City. This has been Chris Chapman, infiltrating your homeworld, puny human, for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, many people listening to this show will be regular attendees of events called Skeptics in the Pub, in which interesting skeptical speakers give a talk in a pub. However, the movement is still growing, and in a couple of months' time, Simon Clare is undertaking an ambitious plan to seed some new groups around Kent, as he explains in his next report.
This September, the southeast tip of England will be the stage for a month-long feast of grassroots scepticism, as the Skeptics in the Pub roadshow passes through Kent on its way to East Sussex. The roadshow was enabled by a grant from the Good Thinking Society and is being organised by the South East Skeptic Society. Stopping off at Canterbury, Tunbridge Wells, Ashford, Folkestone, Maidstone and finally Hastings, the roadshow will not only bring six great speakers to the county, but will hopefully inspire locals to take up the challenge of turning these one-off events into a regular feature of the cultural life of their towns. For full details of the speakers, subjects and dates, just go to www.sitproadshow.co.uk. I just wanted to say a few things about what Skeptics in the Pub is and why we want to share it with the people of Kent and East Sussex. Skeptics in the Pub, or SITP, is in essence no more than a format. It's a very simple and flexible format too. In theory, anyone could use this same format to promote any ideology or worldview they wish to, but it seems that only the skeptics have made it their own. A typical Skeptics in the Pub night consists of a guest speaker in a pub talking for about 45 minutes about any subject. After this, there is a break of about 15 minutes to allow people to get a drink. And then the audience spend the rest of the evening asking questions of the speaker. And sometimes this turns into more of a group discussion than a straightforward Q&A session. Skeptics in the pub nights are often at their very best during the Q&A session, as it's when the nights can really catch fire and go from being a simple lecture to a newsworthy event in themselves. I find the most refreshing thing about SITP events to be the fact that everybody gets to ask their question, no matter what their opinion on the subject and no matter who they are. My favourite Q&A sessions are those where the guest speaker is challenged by somebody who completely disagrees with them. It's almost always done with respect, and during the exchange, everyone gets to listen to both sides. It is a common misconception that Skeptics in the Pub Nights are essentially a club for people who call themselves skeptics already. But the truth is that while those skeptics do feel at home at a Skeptics in the Pub Night, the evening really belongs to the ideas that are being discussed. You never know which speakers will be the ones that make you change your mind about something you thought you knew all about. But if you go along to a few SITP nights, I'm confident that you will change your mind about something. The scientific skepticism that SITP tries to encourage is not supposed to be a way of reinforcing your doubts. I see it as a way of building the structural framework of a truly open mind. The primary aim of the roadshow is simply to put on 6 good, solid events that people thoroughly enjoy. Following on from that, I hope the attendees will enthusiastically embrace the SITP format as something they would like to see more often. Why don't all our towns have a Skeptics in the Pub group, they will ask. Out of those people who ask this question, perhaps a few will decide to remedy the lack of SITP groups in the only way they really can, which is by organising one for themselves. I will be distributing information leaflets about Skeptics in the Pub and the basics of how one might go about setting one up. I'm often surprised when people ask me how on earth I get in contact with the speakers I book for Horsham Skeptics, but then I remember how I felt when I first started. After seeing David Aronovich, my childhood journalistic hero, and the actual P.Z. Myers himself at Brighton's splendid Skeptics in the Pub, I imagine that the organisers must have operated in a completely different social stratum to my own, in which these authoritative and famous people lived. Either this, or that such speakers commanded fees that the groups somehow scraped together from their tiny ticket prices. Perhaps Skeptics in the Pub organisation had some source of money that it used to subsidise those groups. I soon discovered that Skeptics in the Pub relies on the generosity of its guest speakers and the enthusiasm of its volunteer organisers. There is no central control, and there's certainly no central source of money. The speakers, it turns out, really do participate in these events for no more than the cost of their expenses. The organisers get hold of these quality speakers simply by emailing them, tweeting them, or perhaps meeting them at another skeptics group that they've spoken at. Once I decided to start the Horsham group, I was amazed at just how much support there was from the Skeptics in the Pub network, which, by the way, is exactly and only that, a network. There is no central council of skeptics that decide policy or deliberate over strategy. It is a network in the truest sense, a bunch of people with a certain common interest that talk to each other and try to help each other out. From this network, I was put in touch with a whole bunch of good quality speakers who were willing to come and help me get started. I still remember the thrill I got when, for Horsham's inaugural event, I secured Deborah Hyde, the editor of the Skeptic magazine herself. It turned out that I was spoilt for choice when deciding who to invite to our little group, and without exception, all of the 25 guest speakers that I've hosted since then have been helpful, cooperative, and generous with their time, even the ones I was starstruck by. Something that seemed quite daunting at first turned out to be far more rewarding and far less difficult than I expected it to be. This is one of the reasons that I am confident that in organising these one-off shows, we can sow the seeds of new, permanent and sustainable groups. People who haven't even considered running an SITP, like me 3 years ago, will consider, and then decide that yes, they will do it. With the roadshow, I want to show a few hundred people that have never been to a Skeptics in the Pub group before just how much easier it is to run a group than they might imagine, how much support there is out there, and how quickly the work you put in starts to pay off. Not in money, of course, but in feeling like you've done something valuable for your community, both the local community and that of your fellow skeptically inclined brethren. knowing that out of the tens of thousands of people that live in your town, it is you that actually makes it happen, is rather pleasing. The land is crying out for the skeptics in the pub format, and it is you listening to this that has it in your power to conjure a new SITP group for your town. Perhaps with the help of nearby skeptical groups. Maybe established groups will, from time to time, put on one-off shows in other towns and try to get a new group started. If I can run a Skeptics in the Pub group, then anyone can do it. One day we'll look back on this time where some towns still did not have their own Skeptics in the Pub group and wonder how we put up with it for so long. So if you happen to be around Kent in September, these are the talks that are coming to you. On Tuesday the 3rd in Canterbury at the Beer Cart Arms, it's Simon Clare, who is me, giving his talk, my talk, An Atheist's Guide to the Alpha Course. I recommend that one heartily. On Thursday the 5th at Tunbridge Wells, we will be welcoming Anne-Marie Waters, giving her talk about the One Law for All campaign. On Sunday the 8th in Ashford, Lynn Murphy from the University of Sussex will be giving her talk, How America Saved the English Language. And then on Thursday the 12th, we move to Folkestone, where we welcome Martin Poulter, who will be giving the Start Your Own Cult the Scientology Way talk. On Wednesday the 18th in Maidstone, Simon Singh will be giving his talk, Trick or Treatment. And then on Thursday the 26th in Hastings, we end the tour with Robert Llewellyn giving his talk entitled, Electric Cars, They're Rubbish, Aren't They? The Maidstone and Hastings talks are ticketed, but all of the rest you can just turn up to on the night. For all the information, just go to sitproadshow.co.uk. This has been Simon Clare reporting for The Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's show, so do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can find links to buy tickets to Skepticamp and find out more about many of the things on this week's show. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. And whilst there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations help us pay the server bills and those sorts of things, so we really appreciate all the donations. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dawn Firth Godby here, Claire Benson, Dr. T and Sean, they were the Northern Irish people, Simon Clare, Sean Slater, Chris Chapman, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Cardinal Sin, can I have a word?
You can have a two, Cardinal Butterfly, and the second one is you.
I'm chosen to believe the first word is a bless.
It is. That's a good joke, eh?
Yeah, it's all right. Anyway, I want to talk to you about these new indulgences you were giving away through social media.
Hey, it's a Vatican directive. If a people follow the Catholic World Youth Day on social media in real time, then they can earn time off from purgatory.
But it's not exactly a strenuous work in a pursuit of absolution, is it? Yeah, follow the Pope on Twitter to get one step closer to heaven.
Are you quoting a psalm?
No, it was S Club Juniors, isn't it? Either way, my point is that I don't think that you should sell forgiveness in return for the Pope getting a few more followers on Twitter.
He's a getter right into it, though. Listen to this tweet response. Rovs la mau.
Rovs la mau? Is that a Latin?
No, it stands for rolling on Vatican steps, laughing my ass off.
I'm getting too old for all of this, but even that is not my biggest concern.
Well, then what are your troubles?
You have taken it too far, Cardinal Sin. Look at your Facebook page. You are offering 1 week's absolution in return for people sending your lives on a Candy Crush.
It's a difficult game. We're all applying it. You don't think we're kneeling down praying, do you? We're down there keeping the sunlight from the stained glass windows off our iPad screens.
Yeah, well, it has to stop, eh? If you don't rein it in, I'll have to take this all the way to the top.
You don't mean...
I do. I'll write to the supreme Argentinian right hand of God himself.
Really? Why would you take this complaint to Maradona?
Do you think anyone's going to be offended by that?
Not as offended as they are by our accents.
Good point, well made.